mornings on public radio on WNYE 91.5 FM, on HD Radio, Radio in New York, and obviously our live links, our simulcast throughout the world, made possible by Tourism Ireland, The Gathering 2013. Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hamden, Connecticut, Quinnipiac University, and in particular during this month, our programs are again brought to you by Northern Ireland Bureau, Invest Northern Ireland, and friends, many of our sponsors who many of them have been around for decades. I do want to again welcome you to the program and hope that whatever you're doing this Labor Day weekend, that you might give a thought to what Labor Day weekend is in the first place. It is, frankly, it is a weekend and a day dedicated to the labor movement, the unions and to workers and working people. Going to play a little music to get us moving here, and then friends, we will go directly to that lecture by the late Seamus Heaney.
The city of Stockholm, I little thought that I would end up visiting it, never mind end up being welcomed as a guest of the Swedish Academy and the Nobel Foundation. At that particular time, such an outcome was not just beyond expectation, it was beyond conception. In the 1940s, when I was the eldest child of an ever-growing family in rural County Derry, we crowded together in three rooms of a traditional thatched farmstead and lived a kind of den life, which was more or less emotionally and intellectually proofed against the outside world. It was an intimate, physical, creaturely existence, in which the night sounds of the horse in the stable beyond one bedroom wall mingled with the sounds of adult conversation from the kitchen beyond the other. We took in everything that was going on, of course. Rain in the trees, mice on the ceiling, a steam train rumbling along the railway line one field back from the house. But we took it in as if we were in a doze of hibernation. Ahistorical, pre-sexual, in suspension between the archaic and the modern, we were as susceptible and as impressionable as the drinking water that stood in a bucket in our scullery. Every time a passing train made the earth shake, the surface of that water would ripple delicately, concentrically, and in perfect silence. But it wasn't only the earth that shook for us. The air around and above us was alive and signaling also. When a wind stirred the beaches, it also stirred the aerial wire attached to the topmost branch of the chestnut tree. Down it swept, in through a hole bored in the corner of the window frame, right on into the innards of our wireless set, where a little pandemonium of burbles and squeaks would suddenly give way to the voice of the BBC newsreader, speaking out of the unexpected like a deus ex machina. And that voice, too, we could hear in our bedroom, transmitting from beyond and behind the voices of the adults in the kitchen. Just as we could often hear, behind and beyond every voice, the frantic, piercing signalling of Morse code. We could pick up the names of our neighbours being spoken in the local accents of our parents, and in the resonant English tones of the newsreader, the names of bombers and of cities bombed, of war fronts and of army divisions, of numbers of planes lost and of prisoners taken, of casualties suffered and advances made. And always, of course, we would pick up also those other solemn and oddly bracing words, the enemy and the allies. But even so, none of the news of these world spasms entered me as terror. If there was something ominous in the newscaster's tones, there was something torpid about our understanding of what was at stake. And if there was something culpable about such political ignorance at that time, there was something positive about the security I inhabited as a result of it. The wartime, in other words, was pre-reflective time for me, pre-literate, pre-historical in a way. Then as the years went on and my listening became more deliberate, I would climb up on the arm of the big sofa to get my ear closer to the wireless speaker. But it was not still news that interested me. What I was after was the thrill of a story, such as a detective serial about a British special agent called Dick Barton, sort of an Irish name come to think of it, or perhaps a radio adaptation of Captain W.E. Johns' adventure tales about an RAF flying ace called Biggles. Now that the other children were older, of course, there was much more going on in the kitchen, so I had to get close to the actual radio set in order to concentrate my hearing. And in that intent proximity to the dial, I grew familiar with the names of foreign stations, of Leipzig and Oslo and Stuttgart and Warsaw and, of course, with Stockholm. I also got used to hearing short bursts of foreign languages as the dial hands swept round from BBC to Radio Éireann, as Irish radio was called then, from the intonations of London to the intonations of Dublin. And even though I didn't understand what was being said in those first encounters with the gutturals and sibilance of European speech, I had already begun my journey into the wideness of the world. This, in turn, became a journey into the wideness of language, a journey where each point of arrival, whether in one's poetry or one's life, each point of arrival turned out to be a stepping stone rather than a destination. And it is that journey which has brought me now to this honoured spot. And yet the platform here feels to me more like a space station, really, than a stepping stone. So that is why, for once in my life, I am permitting myself the luxury of walking on air. I credit poetry for making this space walk possible. I credit it immediately because of a line I wrote fairly recently, encouraging myself and whoever else might be listening to do just that. Walk on air against your better judgment, the line said. But I credit it ultimately because poetry can make an order as true to the impact of external reality and as sensitive to the inner laws of the poet's being as the ripples that rippled in and out across the water in that scullery bucket 50 years ago. An order where we can at last grow up to that which we stored up as we grew. An order which satisfies all that is appetitive in the intelligence and prehensile in the affections. I credit poetry, in other words, for being both itself and for being a help, for making possible a fluid and restorative relationship between the mind center and its circumference, between the child gazing at the word Stockholm on the face of the radio dial and the man facing the faces that he meets in Stockholm at this most privileged moment. I credit it because credit is due to it in our time and in all time for its truth to life in every sense of that phrase. To begin with, I wanted that truth to life to possess a concrete reliability, and I rejoiced most when the poem seemed most direct, an upfront representation of the world it stood in for, or stood up for, or stood its ground against. Even as a schoolboy, I loved John Keats's Ode to Autumn, for being an ark of the covenant, as it were, between language and sensation. As an adolescent, I loved Gerard Manley Hopkins for the intensity of his exclamations, which were also equations for the rapture and ache I didn't know I knew until I read him. I loved Robert Frost for his farmer's accuracy and his wily down-to-earthness, and Chaucer, in fact, for much the same reasons. Later on, I would find a different kind of accuracy, a moral down-to-earthness, into which I responded deeply and always will in the poetry of Wilfred Owen, the war poet of the First World War, the English war poet, a poetry where a New Testament sensibility absorbs the shock of the new century's barbarism. And then later again, in the pure consequence of Elizabeth Bishop's style, in the sheer obduracy of Robert Lowell's, and in the barefaced confrontation of Patrick Kavanagh's, I encountered further reasons for believing in poetry's ability and its responsibility variously to say what happens, to pity the planet, to be, in Wilfred Owen's words, not concerned with poetry. So this temperamental disposition towards an art that was earnest and devoted to things as they are, this was certainly corroborated by the experience of having been born and brought up in Northern Ireland and having lived with that place, though not in it, for the last quarter of a century. No place in the world prides itself more on its vigilance and its realism. No place considers itself more qualified to censure any flourish of rhetoric or any extravagance of aspiration. So partly as a result of having internalized these attitudes, and partly as a result of growing a skin to protect myself against them, I went for years half avoiding and half resisting the opulence and extensiveness of poets as different as Wallace Stevens and Rainer Maria Rilke, crediting insufficiently the brilliance, the inwardness, the crystalline inwardness of Emily Dickinson, all those forked lightnings and fissures of association, missing the visionary strangeness even in T.S. Eliot. And these more or less cost of attitudes that I had in the beginning were fortified by a refusal to grant the poet any license, any more license than any other citizen, and further induced by having to conduct oneself, as the years went on, having to conduct oneself in a situation of ongoing political violence and public expectation. A public expectation, it has to be said, not of poetry as such, but of political positions variously approvable by mutually disapproving groups. In such circumstances, the mind longs to repose in what Samuel Johnson called with great superb confidence, the stability of truth, even as it recognizes the destabilizing nature of its own operations and inquiries. Without needing to be theoretically instructed, consciousness quickly realizes that it is the site of variously contending discourses. The child in the bedroom listening simultaneously to the domestic idiom of his Irish home and the official idioms of the British broadcaster, while picking up from behind both signals of some other distress. That child was already being schooled for the complexities of an adult predicament, a future where he would have to adjudicate between promptings, among different promptings, variously ethical, aesthetical, moral, political, metrical, skeptical, cultural, topical, typical, post-colonial, and taken altogether simply impossible. And so it was that I found myself in the mid-1970s in another small house, this time in County Wicklow, south of Dublin, with a young family of my own this time, and a slightly less imposing radio set, listening to the rain in the trees and to the news of bombings closer to home. Not only those by the Provisional IRA in Belfast, but equally atrocious assaults in those days in Dublin by loyalist paramilitaries from the north. Feeling puny in my predicaments, as I read about the tragic logic of Osip Mandelstam's fate in the 1930s. Feeling challenged, yet steadfast, in my non-combatant status, when I heard, for example, that one particularly sweet-natured school friend had been interned without trial because he was suspected of having been involved in a political killing. What I was longing for was not quite stability, but an active escape from the quicksand of relativism, a way of crediting poetry without anxiety or apology. In a poem called Exposure, I wrote these stanzas. If I could come on meteorite, instead I walk through damp leaves, husks, the spent flukes of autumn, imagining a hero on some muddy compound, his gift like a slingstone whirled for the desperate. How did I end up like this? I often think of my friend's beautiful prismatic counseling and the anvil brains of some who hate me as I sit weighing and weighing my responsible tristia. For what? For the ear? For the people? For what is said behind backs? Rain comes down through the alders. Its low, conducive voices mutter about letdowns and erosions. And yet each drop recalls the diamond absolutes. I am neither internee nor informer, an inner émigré, grown long-haired and thoughtful, a woodcairn escaped from the massacre, taking protective colouring from bole and bark, feeling every wind that blows, who, blowing up these sparks for their meagre heat, have missed the once-in-a-lifetime portent, the comet's pulsing rose. In one of the poems best known to my generation of students, a poem which could be said to have taken the nutrients, as it were, of the symbolist movement and made them available in capsule form for students, the American poet Archibald MacLeish affirmed that poetry should be equal to, not true. As a defiant statement of poetry's gift for telling truth, but telling it slant, this is both cogent and corrective. Yet there are times when a deeper need enters, when we want the poem not only to be pleasurably right, but compellingly wise. Not only a surprising variation played upon the world, but a retuning of the world itself. We want the surprise to be transitive, if you like the impatient thump that unexpectedly restores the picture to the television set, or the electric shock that sets the fibrillating heart back to its proper rhythm. We want what the woman wanted in the prison queue in Leningrad, standing there, blue with cold and whispering for fear, enduring the terror of Stalin's regime, and asking the poet Anna Akhmatova if she could describe it all, if her art could be equal to it. And this is the want I too was experiencing in those far more protected circumstances in County Wicklow when I wrote the lines I've just quoted. A need for poetry that would merit the definition I gave a few moments ago. Poetry as an order true to the impact of external reality and sensitive to the inner laws of the poet's being. The external reality and inner dynamic of happenings in Northern Ireland between 1968 and 1974 were symptomatic of change. Violent change, admittedly, but change nevertheless. And for the minority living there, change had been long overdue. It should have come early as the result of the ferment of protest on the streets in the late 60s, but that was not to be. And the eggs of danger, which were always incubating, got hatched out quickly. When the Christian moralist in oneself was impelled to deplore the atrocious nature of the IRA's campaign of bombings and killings, and the, so to speak, mere Irish in oneself was appalled by the ruthlessness of the British Army on occasions like Bloody Sunday in Derry in 1972. The minority citizen in oneself, the one who had grown up conscious that his group was distrusted and discriminated against in all kinds of official and unofficial ways, this citizen's perception, was it one with the truth, the poetic truth of the situation, in recognizing that if life in Northern Ireland were ever really to flourish, change had to take place. But that citizen's perception was also at one with the truth in recognizing that the very brutality of the means by which the IRA was pursuing change was destructive of the trust upon which new possibilities would have to be based. Nevertheless, until the British government caved in to the strong-arm tactics of the Ulster Loyalist workers after the Sunningdale Conference in 1974, a well-disposed mind could still hope to make sense of circumstances, to balance what was promising with what was destructive, and do what W.B. Yeats had tried to do a century before, namely, to hold in a single thought reality and justice. After 1974, however, and for 20 long years between then and the ceasefires of August 1994, such a hope proved impossible. The violence from below was then productive of nothing but a retaliatory violence from above. The dream of justice became subsumed into the callousness of reality, and people settled into a quarter century of life, namely, to hold in a single thought reality and justice. After 1974, however, and for 20 long years between then and the ceasefires of August 1994, such a hope proved impossible. The violence from below was then productive of nothing but a retaliatory violence from above. The dream of justice became subsumed into the callousness of reality, and people settled into a quarter century of life waste and spirit waste, of hardening attitudes and narrowing possibilities. All the natural result of political solidarity, traumatic suffering, and sheer emotional self-protectiveness. One of the most harrowing moments in the whole harrowing of the heart in Northern Ireland came when a minibus full of workers were being driven home one January evening in 1976, and the bus was then held up by armed and masked men, and the occupants of the van were ordered at gunpoint to line up on the side of the road. Then one of the masked men, the executioners, so to speak, said to them, "Any Catholics among you, step out here." As it happened, this particular group, with one exception, were all Protestants. So the presumption must have been that the masked men were Protestant paramilitaries about to carry out a tit-for-tat sectarian killing of the Catholic as the odd man out, the one who would have been presumed to be in sympathy with the IRA and all its actions. It was a terrible moment for him, caught between dread and witness, if you like, but he did make a motion to step forward. And then, the story goes, he felt the hand of a Protestant worker in the relative cover of the evening darkness. He felt this hand next to him take his hand, squeeze it, and a signal that said, "No, don't move, we'll not betray you. Nobody need know what faith you are, what party you belong to." All in vain, however, because the man had stepped out of line. But instead of finding a gun at his temple, he was pushed away, and the gunmen opened fire on those remaining in the line. For these were not Protestant terrorists, but members, presumably, of the provisional IRA. It is difficult at times to repress the thought that history is about as instructive as an abattoir, that Tacitus was right, and that peace is merely the desolation left behind after the decisive operations of merciless power. I remember, for example, shocking myself with the thought I had about that friend who was imprisoned in the 70s on suspicion of having been involved in political murder. I shocked myself by thinking that even if he were guilty, he might still perhaps be helping the future to be born, breaking the repressive forms, liberating new potential in the only way that worked, that is to say, the violent way, which therefore became, by extension, the right way. It was like a moment of exposure to interstellar cold, as it were, a reminder of the scary element in which, inner element and outer element, in which human beings must envisage and conduct their lives. But it was only a moment. The birth of the future we desire is surely in the contraction that that terrified Catholic felt on the roadside when another hand gripped his hand. It is not in the gunfire that followed, so absolute and so desolate, if also so much a part of the music of what happens. As writers and readers, as sinners and citizens, our realism and our aesthetic sense makes us wary of crediting the positive note. The very gunfire braces us, and the atrocious confers a great worth on the effort which it calls forth to confront it. We are rightly in awe of the torsions in the poetry of Paul Celan, and we are rightly enamored also of the suspiring voice in Samuel Beckett, because these are evidence that art can rise to the occasion and somehow be the corollary of Celan's stricken destiny as a Holocaust survivor and of Beckett's demure heroism as a member of the French Resistance. Likewise, we are rightly suspicious of that which gives too much consolation in these circumstances. The very extremity of our late 20th century knowledge puts much of our cultural heritage to an extreme test. Only the very stupid or the very deprived can any longer help knowing that the documents of civilization have been written in blood and tears. Blood and tears no less real for being very remote. And when this intellectual predisposition coexists with actualities like Ulster and Israel and Bosnia and Rwanda and a host of other wounded spots on the face of the earth, The inclination is not only not to credit human nature with much constructive potential, but not to credit anything too positive about the work of art. Which I think is why for years I was bowed to the desk like some monk bowed over his prie-dieu, some dutiful contemplative pivoting his understanding in an attempt to bear his portion of the weight of the world, knowing himself incapable of heroic virtue or redemptive effect, but constrained by obedience to the rule to repeat the effort and to repeat the posture, blowing up the sparks for a meager heat, as it were, forgetting faith, if you like, straining towards good works, attending insufficiently to the diamond absolutes, among which absolutes must be counted the sufficiency of that which is absolutely imagined. And then finally, and happily, and not in obedience to the dolorous circumstances of my native province, but in despite of them, I straightened up. I began a few years ago to try to make space in my reckoning and imagining for the marvelous as well as for the murderous. And once again, I'll try to represent the import of that changed orientation with a story out of Ireland. This is a story of another monk, a monk called St. Kevin, holding himself up valiantly in the posture of endurance. It's said that once upon a time St. Kevin was kneeling with his arms stretched out in the form of a cross in Glendalough. It's one of the most beautiful, most wooded, watery places in Ireland, a place which we lived close to when we lived in Wicklow. At any rate, as Kevin knelt and prayed with his arms stretched out, a blackbird mistook his outstretched hand for some kind of roost, and the blackbird swooped down upon it, laid a clutch of eggs in it, and proceeded to nest in it as if it were the branch of a tree. So then Kevin was constrained by his faith in his love of all things great and small, his pity for life, his tenderness towards it. This made Kevin stay immobile for hours and days and weeks, holding his hand out until the eggs were hatched and the young fledglings were able to fly away. Kevin was there, true to life, if subversive of common sense, if you like, at the intersection between natural process and the glimpsed ideal, at one and the same time a signpost and a reminder, manifesting that order of poetry where we can at last grow up to that which we stored up as we grew. St. Kevin's story is, as I say, a story out of Ireland, but it strikes me it could equally well have come out of India or Africa or the Arctic or the Americas, by which I don't mean simply to consign it to the typology of folk tales or to dispute its value by questioning its culture-bound status within a multicultural context. On the contrary, I think the trustworthiness and the travel-worthiness of this story have to do with its local setting. I can indeed, of course, imagine it nowadays, this story being constructed as a... deconstructed, I beg your pardon, being deconstructed as a paradigm of colonialism, with Kevin figuring as the benign imperialist or the missionary in the wake of the imperialist, the one who intervenes and appropriates the indigenous life and interferes with the pristine ecology. And I have to admit indeed that there is an irony in the fact that it should have been such a one who recorded and preserved this instance of the true beauty of the Irish heritage. Kevin's story, after all, appears in the writings of a Norman chronicler, Giraldus Cambrensis, Gerald the Welshman, one of the people who invaded Ireland in the 12th century, one of the people whom the Irish language analyst Geoffrey Keating, Shafrin O'Keating, would call 500 years later, this was Keating's description of Cambrensis, the bull of the herd of those who wrote the false history of Ireland. But even so, I cannot still persuade myself that this manifestation of early Christian civilization should be construed all that simply as a way into whatever is exploitative or barbaric in our history, past and present. The whole conception strikes me rather as being another example of the kind of work I saw a few weeks ago in the small museum in Sparta in Greece on the morning before the news of this year's Nobel Prize in Literature was announced. This was art which sprang from a cult very different from the faith espoused by St. Kevin. Yet in it there was a representation of a roosted bird and an entranced beast and the self-enrapturing man. Except that this time the man was Orpheus and the rapture came from music rather than from prayer. The work itself was a small carved relief and I couldn't help making a sketch of it. And neither could I help copying out the information which was on the card that identified the exhibit and was pinned on the wall beside it. The image moved me, of course, because of its durability and its antiquity, but the description on the card moved me also because it gave a name and it gave credence to that which I myself have been engaged upon for the past 3 decades. Votive panel, the identification card said. Possibly set up to Orpheus by local poet. Local work of the Hellenistic period. Once again, I hope I am not being sentimental or simply fetishizing, as we have learned to say, fetishizing the local. I wish instead to suggest that images and stories of the kind I am invoking here do function as bearers of value. The century has witnessed the defeat of Nazism by force of arms, and the erosion of the Soviet regimes was caused by, among other things, the sheer persistence beneath the imposed ideological conformity, the sheer persistence of cultural values and psychic resistances of the kind that these stories and images enshrine. Even if we have learned to be rightly and deeply fearful of elevating the cultural forms and conservatisms of any nation into a normative and exclusivist system, even if we have terrible proof that pride in the ethnic and religious heritage can quickly degrade into the fascistic, our vigilance on that score should not displace our love and our trust in the good of the indigenous per se. On the contrary, a trust in the staying power and the travel worthiness of such good should encourage us to credit the possibility of a world where respect for every tradition will issue in the creation and maintenance of salubrious political space. In spite of devastating and repeated acts of massacre, assassination, and extirpation, the huge acts of faith which have marked the new relations, for example, between Palestinians and Israelis, between Africans and Afrikaners, and the way in which walls have come down in Europe, iron curtains have opened, all this inspires a hope that new possibility can still open up in Ireland as well. The crux of that problem in Ireland involves an ongoing partition of the island between British and Irish jurisdictions and an equally persistent partition of the affections in Northern Ireland between the British and the Irish heritages. But surely every dweller in the country must hope that the governments involved in the governance of the country can devise institutions which will allow that partition to become a bit more like the net on a tennis court, a demarcation for agile give and take, for encounter and contending, prefiguring a future where the vitality The vitality that flowed in the beginning from those bracing mounds, the enemy and the allies, where that vitality might finally derive from less binary and altogether less binding vocabularies. When the poet W.B. Yeats stood on this platform more than 70 years ago, Ireland was emerging from the throes of a traumatic civil war that had followed fast on the heels of a war of independence fought against the British. The struggle that ensued had been brief enough. It was over by May 1923, some 7 months before Yeats sailed for Stockholm. But it was bloody, savage, and intimate. And for generations to come, it would dictate the terms of the politics of the 26 independent counties of Ireland. That part of the island known first of all as the Irish Free State and then subsequently as the Republic of Ireland. Yeats barely alluded to the Civil War or the War of Independence in his Nobel speech. Nobody understood better than he the connection between the construction or destruction of political order and the founding or foundering of cultural life. But on that occasion, he chose to talk instead about the Irish dramatic movement. This story was about the creative purpose of that movement and its historic good fortune in having not only his own genius to sponsor it, but also the genius of his friends John Millington Synge and Lady Augusta Gregory. Yeats came to Sweden to tell the world that the local work of poets and dramatists had been as important to the transformation of his native place and times as the ambushes of guerrilla armies. And his boast in that elevated prose was much the same as the one he would make in verse more than a decade later in his poem The Municipal Gallery Revisited. There Yeats presents himself amongst the portraits and heroic narrative paintings hanging in the gallery, paintings which celebrate the events and the personalities of recent history. And all of a sudden, he realizes that something truly epoch-making has occurred. This is not, I say, the dead Ireland of my youth, but an Ireland the poets have imagined, terrible and gay. And the poem concludes with two of the most quoted lines of his entire oeuvre. Think where man's glory most begins and ends, and say my glory was I had such friends. And yet, expansive and thrilling as these lines are, they are an instance of poetry flourishing itself rather than proving itself ultimately. They are the poet's lap of honour. And in this respect, if in no other, they resemble what I am doing in this lecture. In fact, I should also quote here on my own behalf some other words from the poem. You that would judge me, do not judge alone this book or that. Instead, I ask you to do what Yeats asked his audience to do and think of the achievement of Irish poets and dramatists and novelists over the past 40 years, among whom I am proud to count great friends. In literary matters, Ezra Pound advised against accepting the opinion of those, quote, who haven't themselves produced notable work. And it is advice I have been privileged to follow, since it is the good opinion of notable workers, and not just notable workers in my own country. It is the good opinion of those that has fortified my endeavour since I began to write in Belfast more than 30 years ago. Yeats, however, as we know, was not all flourish. To the credit of poetry in our century, there must surely be entered in any reckoning his two great sequences of poems entitled 1919 and Meditations in Time of Civil War, the latter of which contains the famous lyric about the bird's nest at his window, where a starling, or stare as he calls it in the poem, has built in a crevice in the old wall. The poet was then living in a Norman tower, which had been very much part of the military history of the country in earlier times. And as his thoughts turned upon the irony of civilizations being consolidated by violent and powerful conquerors who end up commissioning the artists and the architects, he began to associate the sight of the mother bird feeding its young with the image of the honey bee, an image deeply lodged in poetic tradition and always suggestive of a harmonious, industrious, nurturing commonwealth. I'll just read that poem of Yeats's section from Meditations in Time of Civil War. The bees build in the crevices of loosening masonry, and there the mother birds bring grubs and flies. My wall is loosening. Honey bees, come build in the empty house of the stair. We are closed in and the key is turned on our uncertainty. Somewhere a man is killed or a house burned, yet no clear fact to be discerned. Come build in the empty house of the stair. A barricade of stone or of wood, some 14 days of civil war. Last night they trundled down the road, that dead young soldier in his blood. Come build in the empty house of the stair. We had fed the heart on fantasies. The heart's grown brutal from the fair. More substance in our enmities than in our love. Oh, honey bees, come build in the empty house of the stair. I've heard this poem repeated often, in whole or in part, by people in Ireland over the past 25 years. And no wonder, because it is as tender-minded towards life as St. Kevin was, and as tough-minded about what happens in and to life as Homer. The poem knows that massacre will happen again on the roadside, that the workers in the minibus are going to be lined up and shot just after quitting time. But it also credits as a reality the squeeze of the hand, the actuality of sympathy and protectiveness between living creatures. It satisfies the contradictory needs which consciousness experiences at times of extreme crisis. The need on the one hand for a truth-telling that will be hard and retributive, and on the other hand the need not to harden to a point where it denies its own yearnings for sweetness and trust. It is a proof that poetry can be equal to and true at the same time. An example of that completely adequate poetry which the Russian woman sought from Anna Akhmatova, and which William Wordsworth produced at a corresponding moment of historical crisis and personal dismay almost exactly 200 years ago. When the bard Demodocus sings of the fall of Troy and the slaughter that accompanied it, Odysseus weeps, and Homer says that his tears were like the tears of a wife on a battlefield, weeping for the death of a husband fallen in the defense of the city. His famous epic simile continues in Robert Fitzgerald's translation as follows. At the sight of the man panting and dying there, she slips down to enfold him, crying out, then feels the spears prodding her back and shoulders, and goes bound into slavery and grief. Piteous weeping wears away her cheeks, but no more piteous than Odysseus' tears, cloaked as they were now from the company. Even today, 3,000 years later, as we channel surf over so much live coverage of contemporary savagery, highly informed, but nevertheless in danger of growing immune, familiar to the point of over-familiarity with old newsreels of the concentration camp and the gulag, even today Homer's image can still bring us to our senses. The callousness of those spear shafts on the woman's back and shoulders survives time and translation. The image has that documentary adequacy which answers all that we know about the intolerable. But there is another kind of adequacy which is specific to lyric poetry. This has to do with the temple inside our hearing, as Rilke called it, which the passage of the poem calls into being. It is an adequacy deriving from what Mandelstam called the steadfastness of speech articulation, from the resolution and independence that the entirely realized poem sponsors. This has as much to do with the energy released by linguistic fission and fusion, with the buoyancy generated by cadence and tone and rhyme and stanza.
You know, his entire lecture, Seamus Heaney's Nobel laureate lecture,